This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, June 14, 2005. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. Iraqi labor leaders are in the U.S. explaining working conditions under U.S. occupation. Activists in Brazil reach week two of protest against urban transportation. And the case of environmental activist and political prisoner, Jeff Free Lewers. All that and more after these headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. A suicide bomber hit an open market in the Kurdish city of Kirkuk in northern Iraq. Victims of the blast were taken to a neighboring hospital where Dr. Ali Karkuki was working.
The explosion was because the ex-soldiers in the Besh Marga militia were in a long line to receive their salaries from the Kirkuk City Bank. Because all the people living in the north of Iraq, which had served in this militia, get their salaries from this bank. 25 people were killed and 130 wounded, and they were brought to the hospital.
Kurds living in the oil-rich area want the city of Kirkuk to be their capital in an autonomous region of Iraq. However, there is considerable resistance to the Kurds obtaining an independent state. Businesses and shops were shut down in Indian-administered Kashmir today to protest a bomb that killed more than a dozen people yesterday. Shahnawaz Khan reports from Srinagar.
The call for the shutdown strike was given by the hardline faction of All Parties Hurriyat Conference, led by Saeed Ali Gilani. Hardline separatist groups have blamed the government agencies of the bombing, while the government blames the militants for the attack. At least 14 people were killed and around 100 people were wounded when a powerful car bomb exploded near a school in Pulwama town of South Kashmir on Monday. Sandals, shoes and broken vehicle parts were strewn across the road near the site of explosion. Bomb blasts and gun battles occur regularly in Indian-administered Kashmir, despite an 18-month peace process between India and Pakistan. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Shahnawaz Khan from Srinagar, Kashmir.
Thousands of protesters marched for a second day in Sri Lanka's capital, denouncing the government's plan to share tsunami aid with the Tamil Tiger rebels. Puniya Manikavasagam reports from Vavuniya.
Officials said public transport was at standstill for 4 hours due to the protest. Riot police had to use force to stop them entering the premises area of the president's residence. The post-tsunami operational management structure is set up for the government to unite with Tamil Tiger rebels to distribute billions of dollars in aid to tsunami survivors. Buddhist monks and students have joined President Chandrika Kumaratunga's main coalition partner, the Marxist People's Liberation Front, strongly opposing the deal, saying it threatens the country's sovereignty and helps the Tigers to carve out a separate state. The Marxists have threatened to withdraw from the president's coalition, which could make the government collapse if she does not renounce the plan. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Ponnaiya Manikavasagam in Vavuniya, Sri Lanka.
The Mexican military is patrolling at least 8 cities along the U.S.-Mexico border as part of a new security operation. Shannon Young files this report.
A massive operation named Mexico Seguro, or Safe Mexico, began over the weekend ostensibly to combat organized crime and guarantee public security. According to a presidential press release, the operation involves civil authorities and the military, and a number of federal institutions. Authorities have been vague regarding exact locations where the nationwide operation is in effect. However, it is clear that energies are focused on the Laredo, Texas sister city of Nuevo Laredo, where police are now undergoing drug testing. Although the operation includes searches of public areas, homes, offices, and vehicles, as well as scattered military checkpoints throughout urban areas, the presidential spokesperson denied that the operation will militarize the region. For FSRN, this is Shannon Young in Oaxaca.
There are more people in the U.S. living with HIV/AIDS than ever before. Activists say the increase is indicative of poorly performing prevention programs. Rebecca Miles has more.
The 1 million people living with HIV infections represents an increase of 150,000 new cases, and the Centers for Disease Control officials estimate that 3/4 of those infected are men and nearly half are black. According to Terje Andersen from the National Association of People Living with AIDS, the CDC figure is both victory and failure. He says part of the reason the number is so big is that people are living longer, and that the other problem is that new infection rate has remained constant. Advocacy groups say the feds are poorly funding public awareness campaigns. They also accuse the government of politically motivated efforts that emphasize abstinence over all other methods of prevention, including condom use. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rebecca Miles reporting.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Medical marijuana activists went to Capitol Hill today to urge passage of an amendment that would prohibit the Justice Department from prosecuting people who use or grow medical marijuana in the 10 states that have made it legal. The House of Representatives is expected to consider the amendment today as part of the spending bill for the Justice, Commerce, and State Departments. Another amendment to the bill, also expected to be voted on by tonight, would remove libraries and bookstores from Section 215 of the Patriot Act. Last year, the measure ended in a controversial tie after initially having sufficient votes to win. Mitch Jezerich has more from Capitol Hill.
Angel Raich of Oakland, California, who was one of two women who challenged the Justice Department in the Supreme Court on the use of medical marijuana, is now challenging Congress to change the law.
If the Supreme Court takes away my medicine, like they did, and the federal government comes into my home, they will unfortunately execute me. One of the things that very much concerns me, and why I think that it's so important that we pass legislation today to help protect patients, is because of the fact that if we do not pass this, there's a very good chance that the federal government will come into the state of California and those other states and harm sick people.
The measure, sponsored by Republican Representative Dana Rohrenbacher of California and Democrat Maurice Hinchey of New York, would prohibit the Justice Department from using any funds to prosecute or raid the homes of people who use or grow medical marijuana in the 10 states where it is legal. Rohrenbacher says he thinks marijuana is a dangerous drug, but
our founding fathers believed that criminal issues like this should be handled at the state level. It is a travesty for the federal government to step in and override a state law that would permit this type of activity.
By airtime, the measure had yet come up for a vote. However, its sponsors are not optimistic of its passage. They say they are seeking to build momentum, however, by gaining more votes this year than last. For Angel Raich, the battle is far from over.
That means that we have a full year to continue to lobby Congress, to continue to push this issue forward, to continue to educate the public, to get more outrage around the community. And believe me, the moment that the federal government comes into a state and starts harming people, you can guarantee that you're going to start seeing more activism from places that you wouldn't normally expect it.
In less than 54 days, California's injunction against the Justice Department to keep it from going after people who use medical marijuana will expire. The House of Representatives is also considering another amendment to remove libraries and bookstores from Section 215 of the Patriot Act that gives the FBI authority to seek records from those institutions. Last year, the measure died in a tied vote. Before today's vote, we spoke with the sponsor of the measure, Independent Bernie Sanders of Vermont.
People who walk into a bookstore, people who walk into a library, should not have to worry that the book that they are taking out, which may be a controversial book, is going to get into the hands of the United States government. That's not what America is supposed to be about.
The Justice Department says it's never used Section 215 with libraries. Apparently they have asked libraries for information, but using other grand jury subpoenas, but never using the Patriot Act to get information from libraries.
Well, if they haven't used it, then that's a good reason to exempt libraries and bookstores, isn't it? The bottom line is that before the Patriot Act and after our amendment passes, if it does pass, the FBI and other government agencies will certainly still, through normal law enforcement procedures, have the ability to go into a library or a bookstore. But they're going to have to tell an independent judiciary why they feel they need those records. They just can't get those records.
Last year, the same amendment you introduced for a moment had enough votes to pass, had 219 votes, but then the leadership kept the roll call open. We suddenly saw that number go down and it ended up in a tie, meaning it didn't pass.
telling us that we did not have to worry about attacks on democratic rights through the USA Patriot Act. The Republican leadership kept the rolls open 20 minutes longer than regulation time to twist arms and to turn the vote around, and eventually we lost in a 210-210 vote. We are doing our best to line up Democrats. We have a number of conservative Republicans on board, and we'll find out soon enough if we have the votes. I expect it'll be a close vote, but we're cautiously optimistic we can win this.
By airtime, the House had yet voted on that measure as well. Mitch Jezerich, Free Speech Radio News.
Kidnappings and killings of foreigners working in Iraq grab weekly headlines around the world. However, many say those hardest hit by violence in the country are Iraqi workers. Six Iraqi trade union movement leaders started their U.S. tour last week to talk about life and work in Iraq under U.S. occupation. Selena Musuta of the D.C. Radio Co-op has more from Washington, where Iraqi trade unionists met with U.S. national labor leaders and members of Congress.
Falawan could be considered a perfect ally for the U.S. in its quest to win the hearts and minds of the Iraqi people. This trade union leader was forced to be an underground union organizer in factories and construction trades when he refused to sign a Saddam Hussein loyalty pledge. Awan, like the five other trade union leaders he traveled with from Iraq, believe in a democratic process of governing, and all were forced underground by Saddam Hussein's regime because of their ties to union organizing. However, you will not find these six men supporting the occupation in Iraq.
Iraqi workers are working for wages and salaries that is so hardly to believe compared to any other nation.
Awan, who is president of the Federation of Workers' Councils and Unions of Iraq, says that the Iraqi people are facing rising unemployment, low-wage work, and that jobs in Iraq are going to people from countries outside of Iraq.
There's many corporations and international conglomerate that are working in Iraq, and they outsource the job, such as Bechtel. They're sponsoring and running a huge construction project in Iraq, and they're employing people, Iraqis, without even a contract. And there is no safety net or any kind of security.
In late May this year, many union members gathered in Basra for a conference organized by the General Union of Oil Employees to talk about the ownership and control of Iraq's oil reserves. Fale Aboud Umara, part of the six-member tour, had been an oil worker for 28 years before he was detained by the Hussein government while organizing oil workers. Umara also took part in the conference.
And I'm personally, I hold the American administration and the British government responsible for all the destruction of the oil infrastructure in Iraq, because we believe oil is a fundamental base for the Iraqi economy, and its ownership is only to all the Iraqi people.
The Iraqi labor leader's U.S. tour, which is sponsored by U.S. Labor Against the War, will end on June the 26th. Selena Masuta, FSRN in Washington, D.C.
Over 16,000 clerical workers at the University of California's nine state campuses began a three-day strike Monday to demand higher pay. The Coalition of University Employees, or CUE, is unaffiliated with other unions and consists largely of women and people of color. 94% of its members voted to strike after talks reached an impasse this spring. Vinny Lombardo reports from Santa Cruz, where 150 people held a lunchtime rally.
Jose Juan Calderon, a grad student in history, came to support the workers who've helped him through his 5 years at UC Santa Cruz.
People who work for financial aid, they're the people who are making sure that I receive my money. They're the people who do all the filing into my status as student. The people who probably are going to be in a way printing my diploma.
Q member Osiris Ortiz is a coordinator in the Education Partnership Center at UC Santa Cruz.
We're angry. It's not fair. We do a lot of work for UC. Without us, nothing gets processed. Their bills don't get paid. They start looking bad. And, you know, it's about time for them to listen to their own fact-finding report.
Independent arbiter Gerald McKay found UC clericals earned 22% less than counterparts in the Cal State University system. For library assistants, the wage gap is 33%. McKay also found that $20 million earmarked for clerical salaries was diverted to other projects. UC's net income last year was $786 million. Michelle Tapiz, a Q steering committee member, says this week's strike is not about current bargaining, but an expired agreement for wage increases from 2003-2004.
They haven't finished bargaining with us on that, and it's just so we can move on to current bargaining.
Noel Van Nice, UC spokesperson, says Q has been unresponsive and rejected numerous compromise offers.
The university has been bargaining fairly for our clerical workers for over a year now, and we're doing everything we can on our side of the bargaining table.
So far, UC's wage package offers amount to a pay cut, says Tapiz.
It's 0%, but they also want to increase our parking and our health benefits. Whereas before, we had our health benefits for free. It was provided for us. So now they're saying that they want to raise that amount.
When I say labor, you say power.
UC reps are insisting that Q agree to a clause preventing future strikes in sympathy with other unions, which Tapiz says they'll never sign.
Because we are in solidarity with everyone. We go out when everyone goes out.
With finals complete and most students gone for summer, some labor supporters questioned the timing of the action. But Ortiz contends the strike hurts the UC in ways which might not be so obvious.
There's a lot of, fiscal closing and a lot of paperwork that needs to get processed right now because the year's ending, grades need to get in. Clerical workers do all that work and it's not getting done.
The Q strike continues through Wednesday with an action scheduled at the UC office of the president in Oakland. Talks between the union and UC officials resume next week. Vinny Lombardo in Santa Cruz for Free Speech Radio News.
The National Prison Rape Elimination Commission estimates that over 1 million inmates have been raped since 2003. The commission met today in Washington to hear testimony from five U.S. prisoners who have been raped while serving time. Kate Pullman has more.
After being convicted of a white-collar security crime, Keith DeBlasio thought he would just have to serve 5 years in a minimum security prison. He didn't realize he was actually getting a life sentence. Keith contracted HIV after being raped by a gang leader in prison. Keith was raped repeatedly, so many times that he's lost count, after being transferred to a higher security prison.
I couldn't defend myself because he had fellow gang members standing watch. I knew that if I reported him, I would face repercussions from the other gang members and no action was being taken by officials. I felt there was no escape.
Keith is one of the over 1 million inmates raped in federal or state prisons since 2003. He testified at the National Prison Rape Elimination Commission hearing today in Washington, along with four other victims of prison rape. Senator Edward Kennedy spoke at the hearing, saying that prison rape happens on a staggering scale.
We've all heard the shocking estimate that one in every 10 prisoners in the country is raped. We still don't know how many more are victims of sexual abuse and exploitation.
Marilyn Shirley was sexually assaulted by a prison guard in a storage room with no security cameras while another guard kept watch. She testified at the hearing about the hopeless situation of raped inmates.
I will never forget the smell. I can still remember him whispering in my ears during the rape. Do you think you're the only one? Don't even think of telling because it's your word against mine and you will lose. Miller also said, who do you think they'll believe? An inmate like you or a fine upstanding officer like me? Don't even try to talk.
Marilyn's assailant is currently serving a 12-year prison sentence, but she still fears for her life and suffers from debilitating panic attacks. Besides the devastating emotional and physical trauma to victims, prison rapes cost the American legal system countless sums of money. Tom Cahill, a victim of prison gang rape, had trouble readjusting to society after he was raped for 24 hours after being arrested for civil disobedience. He estimated that, because of his recurring imprisonments, his case alone cost the system over $300,000. At the hearing, victims suggested that more security cameras be added and that prison guards be required to work in pairs rather than alone, as was the case in Maryland's assault. Commissioners suggested that a registry for guards with a history of sexual harassment be created, similar to the registry for sex offenders, so guards could not resign from one prison and be rehired at another if a charge is leveled against them. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Kate Pullman.
Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva has promised to fully investigate the worst political situation of his tenure. Lula's Workers' Party is accused of buying congressional votes favorable to Lula's efforts in the legislature. Meanwhile, precarious urban transportation conditions in Brazil have generated protests throughout the country for the past 3 years. The major wave of recent demonstrations has hit the capital of Santa Catarina State, where activists have reached their second week of protests. Toya Mileno and Daniel Juim Moraes report from Florianópolis.
In Florianópolis, a city in the south of Brazil, thousands of students, professors, syndicalists, and citizens are protesting against an 8.8% increase in bus fares. Last year, City Hall tried to make the readjustment, but failed after people's resistance, which was later known as the Turnstile Revolt. This year, demonstrations took to the street for 14 days. Activist César talks about the readjustment and why people are taking to the streets.
Last year in December, during school vacations, the city hall did part of the readjustment, which was 6.8%. Now they increased it to 8.8%, and our bus fare became the most expensive one in the whole country. Before the readjustment, a family here could spend 28% of their income on transportation. Can you imagine how much they will spend now? That's why we're still protesting.
City Hall's excuse for the readjustment was a law sentence based on a request made by the past administration. Norberto Strait is the municipal transportation secretary.
The current administration at City Hall hasn't taken and won't take any initiative to increase the bus fare prices. Now, a decision must be made. Can we appeal it in the law sentence? We can. However, the city government won't take any initiative of this nature.
Last week, Lawas released a letter publicly accusing City Hall of lying. Although the judge ordered the authorization for the increase, the decision to give it or not still depends on City Hall. According to City Hall, an increase in bus fares would keep transportation companies from going bankrupt. As a way to repress the movement, authorities placed criminal charges to 19 activists arrested during the demonstrations and fined a total of $10,000 bail. Adriano Zanotto, president of the Lawyers Association for Human Rights, comments about it.
This is absurd. It's a political movement, not a criminal movement. Anyone who understands a little criminal law must know that to commit a crime such as conspiracy, people must work together to commit the crime. No one over there is united for a crime, but they were united to make a demonstration.
For the second time in 2 years, the population of Florianópolis have been taken to the streets to contest the increase of bus fares price. However, many say that Brazil's entire transportation system is a problem and the resistance will continue until the prices are reduced. From Florianópolis, Brazil, Toya Mileno and Daniel Guimarães to Free Speech Radio News.
Alleged international terrorist and former CIA operative Luis Posada Carriles, who is wanted in Venezuela for the bombing of an aircraft which resulted in the death of 73 people, remains in jail in El Paso, Texas today after an immigration hearing there yesterday. As Leslie Clark reports, the El Paso hearing is just the beginning of what is expected to be a long legal battle involving Posada and the U.S. government.
Posada has a long history of working with the United States government and so is entitled to retain his permanent resident status, according to his attorney, Eduardo Soto.
There are a voluminous series of documents that shows that he indirectly and directly worked with the Central Intelligence Agency. And he was also a member of the U.S. Armed Services. He was commissioned as a second lieutenant. If you are in the employ, like my client was, for the amount of years that he was, it's very difficult for him to move about.
Soto says that means his client wasn't able to return to the United States within a year of his departure, as required by immigration law. And although it's Soto's contention that Posada is legally in the United States, he has asked for political asylum for his client. But activists like Gloria Larriva says Posada should be extradited to Venezuela for crimes he's committed, regardless of his legal status in this country.
So we have a real conglomeration of people from around the country who know of the case of Luis Posada Carriles, are angered that he dared to come to the United States to seek asylum after committing multiple murders against people, innocent people, simply because they were Cuban.
Juan Jose Gutierrez came to El Paso from Los Angeles to join the demonstration. He says he hopes President George Bush won't make a mockery of his own policy, stating that anyone who harbors a terrorist will be considered a terrorist.
We don't want a double standard to be established and upheld in America, where we end up with a policy that was stated a certain way, but it ended up meaning that there are good and bad terrorists. The bad terrorists are those that do terrorist acts that we don't like, and the good terrorists are those that do our bidding. That's un-American. That's unacceptable.
Posada's trial on his asylum request is scheduled for the end of August. In the meantime, Posada's attorney says the government has given him volumes of evidence against his client to be considered at trial. The activists in El Paso this week say Americans should be concerned about the case, saying it's not just a matter of everyone's safety, but also a matter of humanity. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leslie Clark in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
This weekend marked the fifth anniversary of the arrest of political prisoner Jeff Free Lures. He was sentenced to more than 22 years in Oregon State Prison for burning three SUVs in protest to their negative environmental impact. The FBI has placed environmental action groups such as the Earth Liberation Front, with which Lures claims no affiliation, at the top of their domestic terrorism list, labeling them eco-terrorists. In Portland, FSRN's Michael Newman has more.
If he burned those SUVs because he hated the dealership, or it was insurance fraud, or random vandalism, he would have gotten around, 2 to 4 years of jail. But because he claimed that the reason he did it was based on philosophical values and political values, he was sentenced to almost quadruple what he normally would have gotten for punishment.
That was Lauren Regan, a federal environmental law attorney who's been working on Jeffrey's case throughout his sentence. She was a speaker at one of the 25 events held around the world during the second annual International Weekend of Solidarity with Jeffrey Lures. This massive nonviolent gathering is in recognition of Jeffrey's status as a political prisoner, having been handed an abnormally severe sentence of 22.8 years for a crime with no injuries and relatively minor damages. Again, attorney Lauren Regan.
People are turning to direct action as the last resort in order to try to stop what they feel is an overwhelmingly bad situation.
Jeffrey's sentence was issued under the mandatory minimum guidelines of Oregon's Measure 11, yet aggravating factors within his case have since been challenged by a federal ruling designed ironically to curb abuse by so-called activist judges. Jeffrey is now a certified paralegal and will have his appeal heard by a judge who could potentially erase a daunting 16 years from his sentence. On May 18th of this year, FBI Deputy Assistant Director John Lewis stated that one of today's most serious domestic terrorism threats comes from environmental groups like the ELF. This despite the fact that in 13 years of activity, the ELF have never harmed a human or an animal. Lauren Regan offers a reaction.
It is like crying wolf. You diminish what happened to the victims of those real terrorist incidents by labeling dissenters as terrorists.
In May of 1989, activist Peg Millett was arrested by the FBI in an Earth First sting operation for a deed she undertook to protest the desecration of Native American sacred lands. She served 3 years without parole, yet continues to campaign against environmental destruction. She described to me her thoughts on what prevents a healthy dialogue between government, activists, and the industries they oppose.
Yeah, common ground is very important. When I was in trial, it was really important for me because the people who were opposing us were so adamantly trying to make us non-human entity and to separate us from themselves.
This is Michael Newman reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Portland.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Aura Bogado.